Today, our top 10 practice-changing stories from 2020. Welcome to the Carlatt Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlatt Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue. Each year, we hope to bring you clinical updates that can change your practice. And today, we're going to look back at the top 10 from our monthly print edition in 2020. 1. Where to start with tardive dyskinesia?
If your inbox is like mine, it's been flooded over the past 3 years with updates about the new VMAT2 inhibitors for tardive dyskinesia, valbenazine, Ingrezza, and deutrabenazine, Austedo. So we were a bit hesitant to cover this subject. Is there really anything new to say here? Until we realized something was missing. We couldn't find any articles that tackled the most basic question we all struggle with. Which one of these should you start with? We braved our answer in January 2020. Valbenazine, Ingrezza. But only by a narrow margin.
Okay, both of these have the same mechanism of action, the same side effect profile, and the same cost. So why valbenazine?
It's just a practical reason. Valbenazine is dosed once a day, while deutrabenazine is dosed twice a day and has to be taken with food. It sounds like a trivial difference, but for patients who are trying to take their meds regularly, that's a big deal.
Yes, but what if they are on an antipsychotic that's dosed twice a day? Like ziprasidone, clozapine, quetiapine, or acenapine? Then the twice-a-day deutetrabenazine, Austedo, would fit right into their dosing schedule.
Well, let's be realistic about schizophrenia. This illness is marked by negative symptoms, and those make patients unable to shower or brush their teeth with anything like a daily frequency. So expecting them to remember to take an antipsychotic twice a day is a bit much. The antipsychotics you mentioned, Kelly, were dosed twice a day, or three times a day, in their original studies. But all of them, except maybe ziprasidone, do have studies showing that giving them once a day can be done without loss of efficacy. That's how I dose them, unless the patient has trouble with side effects that worsen when the blood level peaks, particularly orthostasis.
Any other reason to choose valbenazine?
This next reason is a bit more tentative, since the two have never been compared head-to-head, but valbenazine did seem to have the better efficacy of the two in the clinical trials. You'd need to treat 4 patients to see a meaningful response with valbenazine compared to 7 patients for deutrabenazine. Another difference between them is that deutratetrabenazine is FDA approved in Huntington's disease and TD, while valbenazine is only FDA approved in TD. That might look like an advantage for deutratetrabenazine, but there was a slight increase in suicidality with deutratetrabenazine in the Huntington's trials, and unfortunately, that earned it a black box warning about suicidality in that population. So even though it's not the TD population, it does have a black box warning about suicidality, which valbenazine does not. Now, neither of these drugs seem to increase suicidality in the tardive dyskinesia studies, but I wouldn't be surprised if there is a small risk of that which shows up in the post-marketing studies. Both are based on tetrabenazine, an older VMAT2 inhibitor that has been used for TD since the 1970s. Tetrabenazine never caught on because it has a clear risk of causing depression and suicidality.
Unfortunately, for many patients, there is one thing that is likely to get in the way of using either of them: cost. Both cost over $70,000 a year, but there are many other ways to treat tardive dyskinesia, and in our January issue, we list 8 off-label treatments that are worth considering. Two, inflammation and depression.
This next article came out of a conversation I had a while back with Vladimir Maletek. He works with a lot of treatment-resistant depression, and I asked him if he used genetic testing. He said he rarely ordered it because the research is not so good for most tests and the results can be misleading. But he did use another test in his practice, the C-reactive protein, or CRP, which is a marker of inflammation. Arguably, this marker has better evidence to predict antidepressant response than the famous serotonin transporter gene that's included in many commercial genetic panels. And it's a very low-cost test, around $20 to $40. A high CRP indicated better response to tricyclics and dopaminergics like bupropion and possibly pramipexole, and a lower chance of responding to an SSRI. Inflammation is a pretty common problem. It contributes to about 30% of depressions out there, and among treatment-resistant cases, the rate is closer to 50%. In our February issue, I interviewed Andrew Miller about inflammation and depression. Dr. Miller could have flooded us with cascades of cytokines and interleukins and other inflammatory signals, but he kept it very practical. Read the article and you'll know how to spot inflammation in depressed patients, how to order and interpret the CRP, and how to choose medications when inflammation is high, including our dosing tips on this D3 agonist, pramipexole.
And there's something else at the end of the interview that really changed my practice. You see, I've used the CRP to guide treatment, and it really does work. I'm thinking of patients who had not responded to any antidepressants, but had elevated CRPs and got better with a dopaminergic. The patients are very grateful. It changed their lives. But Dr. Miller pointed out a catch. We may just be treating the symptom, not the cause. Inflammation wears down dopamine receptors in the brain, so naturally these patients feel less depressed when given a medicine like bupropion or pramipexole. But that doesn't change the fact that inflammation is wreaking havoc on the rest of the body, causing vascular disease, diabetes, and hastening the aging process, so it's not enough to treat their depression. We also need to address the underlying issue with lifestyle changes such as diet and exercise, because we don't have good medication options that reduce systemic inflammation. Three, lumateperone, Caplyta, a serotonin 5-HT2A story. 2020 brought the 5-HT2A serotonin receptor into the spotlight with the release of lumateperone, Caplyta, a novel antipsychotic that is distinguished by its low D2 dopamine blockade. Dopamine is not the only route to psychosis. Hallucinogens like LSD cause psychosis by activating the 5-HT2A receptor, and antipsychotics like pimavanserin and the new addition lumateperone appear to treat psychosis by blocking this receptor. These medications block the 5-HT2A receptor in different ways. Pimavanserin is an inverse agonist, which means it activates the receptor, but causes it to act the opposite of the way of an agonist would. While lumateperone is an antagonist, which means it blocks the receptor, preventing agonists like LSD from activating it.
Perhaps some patients will benefit from this mechanism who haven't responded to dopamine blockers, but so far we have no evidence of that, and there's no suggestion that lumateperone is more effective than any antipsychotics already on the market. Where lumateperone does stand out is in tolerability. Antipsychotics with low dopamine blockade, like clozapine and quetiapine, tend to cause a lot less muscle stiffness and other extrapyramidal side effects like akathisia. Lumateperone held up to that promise, and based on the available data, it also appears to have a favorable metabolic profile as well. The 5-HT2A story deepened when researchers from Mass General released a controlled trial this year showing that the 5-HT2A inverse agonist pimavanserin, that's Nuplazid, augmented antidepressants in depression. We covered pimavanserin in our April issue, and a few months later we came across some unpublished controlled trials suggesting that the other 5-HT2A blocker, lumateperone, treats bipolar depression. Those trials were presented at the International Society for Bipolar Disorders conference, and we covered them in our August issue. And, as a reminder that nothing in the brain is straightforward, 5-HT2A took a different turn in the evolving story of psilocybin in depression. This year, the FDA fast-tracked psilocybin for major depression, based in part on an uncontrolled trial from 2016 that found remarkable and sustained antidepressant effects from psilocybin in treatment-resistant depression. The twist in this story? psilocybin is a 5-HT2A agonist. While the two antipsychotics we've talked about that are also showing promise in depression are 5-HT2A blockers. How is it that medications with opposite effects on this mysterious receptor can still treat depression is an unanswered question.
Four, the best first-line medications. It's often said that in psychopharmacology, everyone has one and all must have prizes. But David Oster doesn't think so. His psychopharmacology algorithm project takes the bold move of naming the top meds in each category to start with. His reasoning is based on efficacy, tolerability, and cost. And for the efficacy question, he depends on meta-analysis and real-world comparative studies. For depression, that's bupropion, escitalopram, and sertraline. For classic euphoric mania, it's lithium. And for dysphoric mania in mixed states, it's quetiapine. For bipolar depression, it's lamotrigine, lithium, quetiapine, or lurasidone. After our interview, Dr. Osser added cariprazine, Vraylar, to that list, but he shared with us one reservation about this latest addition. Cariprazine's efficacy in bipolar depression is about half that of the other atypical antipsychotics, based on its number needed to treat. We interviewed Dr. Osser in our April edition, along with an update on schizophrenia that gives you a three-step approach to antipsychotic selection. Dr. Osser's algorithms are available online at www.psychopharm.mobi. And this fall, he released the full details in a brand new book. Five, you can use trazodone for depression.
It's often said that trazodone is a good hypnotic but a terrible antidepressant. But let's look at the facts. Trazodone has a low risk of sexual side effects and weight gain. Trazodone improves sleep quality, while SSRIs tend to disrupt sleep a little. Trazodone has a unique mechanism of action, which makes it reasonable to try when other options have failed. And its efficacy is sound. It's backed by over 24 randomized controlled trials, and it's been demonstrated in severe depression and hospitalized cases. Trazodone compared favorably when tested head-to-head with other antidepressants, including tricyclics. So why is trazodone so often overlooked in depression? The reason is fatigue. But there's a way around that side effect. Most studies dose trazodone twice a day, but trazodone worked just as well and caused a lot less fatigue when the entire dose was given at night. Our May issue has other dosing secrets for trazodone, such as how to titrate it to prevent metabolites from shooting up that can get in the way of its therapeutic effects.
Six, what to do if you run out of medication options? When is enough enough? Dr. Joe Goldberg attempted an answer in our June interview. At least when it comes to rolling out another antidepressant in treatment-resistant depression. And here's his answer. I don't think I would ever say enough is enough, but there is a point at which the probability of medicines having a big effect becomes very, very low. In depression, that point is pretty black and white in my mind. Five trials. At that point, Dr. Goldberg will move toward ECT, ketamine, or high-dose MAOIs. Or, hearkening back to our inflammation story, the D3 dopamine agonist pramipexole. But the heart of this interview is where Dr. Goldberg shares his psychological approach to working with people with chronic depression who don't respond to medications. We paired that with an interview with Dr. Lois Choi Kane on borderline personality disorder, another area where there are real limitations to what medications can accomplish. Dr. Choi Kane presented a practical psychotherapeutic approach to borderline personality disorder that can be adapted into the medication visit. It centers on helping them work toward realistic life goals, particularly those that provide them with a structured role in work, society, or community. Seven, Psilexan for anxiety.
In 2015, Robert Post shared some research on a medication for generalized anxiety disorder that had twice the effect size of SSRIs. The medication, Silexin, is a patented extract of lavender plant, and it's available as a prescription in several European countries. But after some sleuthing, I was able to track down an over-the-counter product in the US that is made by the same German pharmaceutical firm, Schwab Pharmaceuticals, that produces the prescription product. Generalized anxiety disorder is not very responsive to medications overall, so I've had a lot of opportunity to try Silexin in patients who did not respond to conventional therapies. Currently, that's over 500 patients, and my close colleagues who use Silexin have added another 3,000 to the count. The responses have been pretty good, consistent with what is reported in the research, and the extract has been well tolerated. And what struck me most about using Silexin was seeing patients who've been on benzodiazepines for years, and after a month on Silexin, they lowered their benzo dose on their own, or weren't taking it at all for the first time since I'd known them.
Although derived from a plant, Silexin's pharmacologic properties are more in line with conventional medications than with most complementary therapies. But then again, valproic acid and bupropion were both derived from plants. Like the benzos, Silexin has GABAergic effects, but it lacks their addictive and rewarding qualities. And like pregabalin, Silexin inhibits calcium channels. Like ketamine, Silexin is an NMDA antagonist. And like buspirone and vortioxetine, it is a serotonin 1A agonist. Eight, signs of a lithium responder. Dr. Osser gave lithium top billing as a medication for bipolar mania, but only for a certain type, the classic euphoric textbook case of mania. That got us wondering what other signs might predict that someone will be a good lithium responder. And for that, we turn to Dr. Janusz Rybakowski, whose research has helped identify the characteristics of an excellent lithium responder. One, clear-cut mood episodes with full remission between them. So there's a clear difference between the normal self, the depression, and the mania. Two, relative lack of mixed states and rapid cycling. This doesn't mean that people with mixed states and rapid cycling won't respond to lithium. It's just that they are less likely to get a full recovery on it. Three, few past episodes or hospitalizations. Four, depressive episodes that follow manic episodes, as if following the law of what goes up must come down. 5. Relative absence of psychiatric comorbidity, substance abuse, childhood trauma, and psychotic features. Generally excellent lithium responders have few psychiatric comorbidities, although one study by Dr. Rybakowski found that comorbid panic disorder predicted lithium response. 6. A family history of bipolar disorder and or lithium response. 7. Hypothymic traits. Extroverted, natural leader, high energy, short sleeper. Dr. Rybakowski estimates that 30% of bipolar patients are excellent lithium responders, and starting them on lithium early in the course can help them stay well for years.
Dr. Rybakowski was one of the pioneers who discovered lithium's antiviral properties in the early 1980s, and he is now part of an international team that's investigating lithium's potential role against the coronavirus. But he shared with us a warning. Viral infections are a common trigger of lithium toxicity. Read more in our August issue, which also features a three-stage classification system for diagnosing neuropsychiatric complications of COVID infection.
Nine, when should you consider hormonal therapies for depression? When I treat women with depression, they often ask about whether their hormones are contributing to their mood problems. From young women who've started birth control pills to women with premenstrual dysphoria, to women in the peripartum or perimenopausal years, it is hard to ignore the relevance that hormones play. But what exactly is that role, and what do we do about it? In our October issue, Ruta Nonax from Massachusetts General Hospital's Perinatal and Reproductive Psychiatry Clinical Research Program shed some light on this confusing area. Here's what we learned. Perimenopausal changes do increase the risk of depression, and hormone replacement therapy, HRT, can make antidepressants work better. But the studies are small and the risks are significant. Women can limit those risks by limiting the time they spend on HRT to 5 years. HRT is generally avoided for depression in the postmenopausal phase, but can be used second or third line for depression that occurs as menopause is developing. The exact doses for the HRT are in our October issue, along with a list of birth control pills that have the highest and lowest chance of disrupting mood. Generic spotlight on Remeltion.
We all get flooded with educational materials when a new medication is launched. At the Carlat Report, we take a different tactic. We put a spotlight on meds when they are going into the generic market. And 2020's unsung entry was Remeltion, formerly known as Rozarum. This sleep medicine was rarely used when it was on patent because few insurers would pay for it, and a lot of physicians had the impression that this melatonin agonist wasn't a very strong hypnotic. In our November-December issue, we published a full review of Remeltion, and here are the highlights. Yes, Remeltion is not very potent, but then again, neither are any of the other sleep medicines on the market. What makes Remeltion stand out is that it's not addictive, it is not a controlled substance, and it does not cause altered mental states along the lines of sleepwalking, sleep eating, and, God forbid, sleep driving. That makes Remeltion a good first-line choice for people with a history of addiction and for the elderly, where Remeltion is one of few hypnotics that are not discouraged by the Beer's list of risky medications in the elderly. Our review also opened up an unanswered question that some of our readers have written us about. Most sleep medications are woefully inadequate in their efficacy, improving on placebo by only about 10 minutes in terms of how much they hasten the time it takes to fall asleep, and doing little to improve the quality or duration of that sleep. So why do patients ask for them, and keep requesting nightly hypnotics, even after testing their meek benefits on their own? Well, like I said, that is an unanswered question, but it's worth noting that most sleep medications have other effects that are unrelated to their therapeutic use. They lower anxiety, they dampen racing, ruminative thoughts, and they are rewarding. Remeltion is like a sleep medicine that's been stripped bare of all those tangential effects. So your patients might have a little trouble adjusting to it if you're switching from a benzo or a Z-hypnotic to Remeltion. But Remeltion is not without tangential benefits. In our review, we identified two psychiatric conditions where Remeltion might have therapeutic effects beyond its hypnotic benefits: bipolar disorder and delirium.
And since Remeltion is a lot safer in the elderly, we recommend trying it in older adults who need to wean off other hypnotics due to falls or other problems. But what about in children? We're not going there yet, but the manufacturer Takeda did, despite a lack of any evidence in younger patients. In 2006, they released an ad showing children getting onto a school bus and sitting in class with the voiceover, "Rozarum would like to remind you that it's back to school season. Ask your doctor today if Rozarum is right for you." The FDA promptly pulled the ad from circulation. The other big generic launch in 2020 was pregabalin, Lyrica, which has decent evidence in generalized anxiety disorder, social anxiety disorder, and alcohol use disorders. Generics are usually not available as soon as the patent expires. Everything from legal battles to manufacturing problems can delay their release. Once released, insurers start to cover it a bit more, and the price goes down a little, but it takes about a year for the cost to really fall because the FDA grants exclusivity to the first generic manufacturer to actually produce it. So, what's on our radar for 2021? We hope to see generic equivalents of the smoking cessation aid, varenicline, Chantix, and the sublingual antipsychotic acenapine, Safris. We've often wondered why insurers don't cover Chantix, while they willingly cough up the $170 billion a year, or 9% of the healthcare budget, that's due to nicotine-related illnesses. Maybe this turn to generic will convince them that parity isn't just a law, it also makes economic sense. And now for the word of the day, immediate memory.
Immediate memory is a type of short-term memory that's usually measured by the digit span, where you ask a patient to repeat a random list of digits. Few people can remember more than 12 random items, and the average is 7, which is why phone numbers are 7 digits long. Information that is stored in immediate memory is short-lived, fading after a few minutes unless it's rehearsed. The brain selectively transfers relevant information into long-term memory, and most of that pruning occurs during sleep. Join us next week and next year for an interview with Brett Stevens, who shares his lived experience with bipolar disorder and offers some useful tips to help patients get back on their feet after a manic episode.
You only have 4 days left to earn your 2020 CME credits. And you can earn 12 of them right now at thecarlattreport.com. Just complete the 6-question test for each monthly issue. And if you're not a subscriber, use the promo code PODCAST to get $30 off your first year subscription. And as an added bonus, you'll help keep this publication free of industry support.